quite know why he's doing it. He just feels that something like this requires some kind of sanctified silence before one heads off. He considers whether the paintwork of the Saab will become terribly dirty as a result of this. He supposes so. It's a pity and a shame, he realizes, but not much can be done about it. He gives the tires a couple of evaluating kicks. They're in fine order, they really are. Good for at least another 3 winters, he estimates, judging by his last kick. Which quickly reminds him about the letter in the inside pocket of his jacket. So he fishes it out to check whether he has remembered to leave instructions about the summer tires. Yes, he has. It's written here under Saab Plus Accessories. Summer tires in the shed. And then clear instructions that even a genuine moron could understand about where the rim bolts can be found in the trunk. Uwe slides the letter back into the envelope and puts it in the inside pocket of his jacket. He glances over his shoulder into the parking area. Not because he's bothered about that damned cat, obviously. He just hopes nothing's happened to it, because then there'll be hell to pay from Uva's wife. He's quite sure about that. He just doesn't want to ticking off because of the damned cat, that's all. The sirens of an approaching ambulance can be heard in the distance, but he barely takes any notice. Just gets into the driver's seat and starts the engine. Opens the back electric window a couple of inches. Gets out of the car, closes the garage door. Fixes the plastic tube tightly over the exhaust pipe. Watches the exhaust fumes slowly bubbling out of the other end of the tube. Then feeds the tube through the open back window. Gets into the car, closes the door, adjusts the wing mirrors. Fine-tunes the radio one step forward and one step back. Leans back in the seat, closes his eyes, feels the thick exhaust smoke cubic inch by cubic inch, filling the garage and his lungs. It wasn't supposed to be like this. You work and pay off the mortgage and pay taxes and do what you should. You marry, for better or for worse, until death do us part. Wasn't that what they agreed? Uwe remembers quite clearly that it was. And she wasn't supposed to be the first one to die. Wasn't it bloody well understood that it was his death they were talking about? Well, wasn't it? Uwe hears a banging at the garage door, ignores it, straightens the creases of his trousers, looks at himself in the rearview mirror, wonders whether perhaps he should have put on a tie. She always liked it when he wore a tie. She looked at him then as the most handsome man in the world. He wonders if she will look at him now. If she'll be ashamed of him turning up in the afterlife unemployed and wearing a dirty suit. Will she think he's an idiot who can't even hold down an honest job without being phased out? Just because his knowledge has been found wanting on account of some computer? Will she still look at him the way she used to, like a man who can be relied on? A man who can take responsibility for things and fix a water heater if necessary? Will she like him as much now that he's just an old person with no purpose in the world? There's more frenetic banging at the garage door. Uwe stares sourly at it. More banging. Uwe thinks to himself that it's enough now. That will do, he roars, and opens the door of the Saab so abruptly that the plastic tube is dislodged from between the window and the molding and falls onto the concrete floor. Clouds of exhaust fumes pour out in all directions. The pregnant foreign woman should probably have learned by now not to stand so close to doors when Uwe is on the other side. But this time she can't avoid getting the garage door right in her face when Uwe throws it open, violently. Uwe sees her and freezes. She's holding her nose, looking at him with that distinct expression of someone who just had a garage door slammed into her nose. The exhaust fumes come pouring out of the garage in a dense cloud, covering half of the parking area in a thick, noxious mist.
If you have to you have to watch out when the door's being opened, Uwe manages to say.
What are you doing? The pregnant one manages to bite back at him, while watching the Saab with its engine idling and the exhaust spewing out of the mouth of the plastic tube on the floor.
Me? Nothing,
says Uwe indignantly, looking as if he'd prefer to shut the garage door again. Thick red drops are forming in her nostrils. She covers her face with one hand and waves at him with the other.
I need to lift to the hospital,
she says, tilting her head back. Uwe looks skeptical.
What the hell? Pull yourself together, it's just a nosebleed.
She swears in something Uwe assumes is Farsi and clamps the bridge of her nose hard between her thumb and index finger. Then, she shakes her head impatiently, dripping blood all over her jacket.
Not because of the nosebleed.
Uwe's a bit puzzled by that. Puts his hands in his pockets.
No, no, well then.
She groans.
Patrick fell off the ladder.
She leans her head back so that Uwe stands there talking to the underside of her chin.
Who's Patrick? Uwe asks the chin.
My husband,
the chin answers.
The lanky one? Asks Uwe.
That's him, yeah, says the chin.
And he fell off the ladder?
Uwe clarifies.
Yes, when he was opening the window.
Right, what a bloody surprise. You can see that one coming from a mile away.
The chin disappears and the large brown eyes reappear. They don't look entirely pleased.
Are we going to have a debate about this or what?
Uwe scratches his head, slightly bothered.
No, no, but can't you drive yourself? And that little Japanese sewing machine you arrived in the other day? He tries to protest.
I don't have a driver's license,
she replies, mopping blood from her lip.
What do you mean you don't have a driver's license?
Asks Uwe, as if her words are utterly inexplicable to him. Again, she sighs impatiently.
Look, I don't have a driver's license and that's all. What's the problem?
How old are you?
Uwe asks, almost fascinated now.
30,
she says impatiently.
30? And no driver's license? Is there something wrong with you?
She groans, holding one hand over her nose and snapping her fingers with irritation in front of Uwe's face.
Focus a bit, Uwe. The hospital. You have to drive us to the hospital.
Uwe looks almost offended.
What do you mean, us? You'll have to call an ambulance if the person you're married to can't open a window without falling off a ladder.
I already did. They've taken him to the hospital, but there was no space for me in the ambulance. And now, because of the snow, every taxi in town is occupied, and the buses are getting bogged down everywhere.
Scattered streams of blood are running down one of her cheeks. Uwe clamps his jaws so hard that he starts gnashing his teeth.
I can't trust bloody buses. The drivers are always drunks, he says quietly,
his chin at an angle that might make someone believe he was trying to hide his words on the inside of his shirt collar. Maybe she notices the way his mood shifts as soon as she mentions the word bus. Maybe not. Anyway, she nods, as if this in some way clinches it.
Right then, so you have to drive us.
Uwe makes a courageous attempt to point threateningly at her, but to his own dismay, he feels it's not as convincing as he might have hoped.
There are no have-tos around here. I'm not some bloody mobility service, he manages to say at last.
But she just squeezes her index finger and thumb even harder around the bridge of her nose, and nods as if she has not in any way listened to what he just said. She waves with irritation towards the garage and the plastic tube on the floor, spewing out exhaust fumes, thicker and thicker against the ceiling.
I don't have time to fuss about this anymore. Get things ready. So we can leave. I'll go and get the children.
The children?
Uwe shouts after her, without getting any kind of answer. She's already swanned off on those tiny feet that look wholly undersized for that large pregnant bump, disappearing around the corner of the bicycle shed and down towards the houses. Uwe stays where he is as if waiting for someone to catch up with her and tell her that actually Uwe had not finished talking. But no one does. He tucks his fists into his belt and throws a glance at the tube on the floor.
It's actually not his responsibility if people can't manage to stay on the ladders they borrow from him. That's his own view.
But of course, he can't avoid thinking about what his wife would have told him to do under the circumstances if she'd been here. And of course, it's not so difficult to work it out, Uwe realizes. Sadly enough. At long last, he walks up to the car and pokes off the tube from the exhaust pipe with his shoe. Gets into the Saab, checks his mirrors. Puts it into first and pulls out into the parking area. Not that he cares particularly about how the pregnant foreign woman gets to the hospital, but Uwe knows very well that there'll be no end of nagging from his wife if the last thing Uwe does in this life is to give a pregnant woman a nosebleed and then abandon her to take the bus. And if the gas is going to be used up anyway, he may as well give her a lift there and back. Maybe then that woman will leave me in peace, thinks Uwe. But of course, she doesn't. Chapter 12. A man who was Uwe, and one day he had enough. People always said Uwe and Uwe's wife were like night and day. Uwe realized full well, of course, that he was the night. It didn't matter to him. On the other hand, it always amused his wife when someone said it, because she could then point out while giggling that people only thought Uwe was the night because he was too mean to turn on the sun. He never understood why she chose him. She loved only abstract things like music and books and strange words. Uwe was a man entirely filled with tangible things. He liked screwdrivers and oil filters. He went through life with his hands firmly shoved into his pockets. She danced. "You only need one ray of light to chase all the shadows away," she said to him once, when he asked her why she had to be so upbeat the whole time. Apparently, some monk called Francis had written as much in one of her books. "You don't fool me, darling," she said with a playful little smile and crept into his big arms. "You're dancing on the inside, Uwe, when no one's watching. And I'll always love you for that, whether you like it or not." Uwe never quite fathomed what she meant by that. He'd never been one for dancing. It seemed far too haphazard and giddy. He liked straight lines and clear decisions. That was why he had always liked mathematics. There were right or wrong answers there, not like the other hippie subjects they tried to trick you into doing at school, where you could argue your case. As if that was a way of concluding a discussion. Checking who knew more long words. Uwe wanted what was right to be right and what was wrong to be wrong. He knew very well that some people thought he was nothing but a grumpy old sod without any faith in people. But, to put it bluntly, that was because people had never given him reason to see it another way. Because a time comes in every man's life when he decides what sort of man he's going to be, the kind who lets other people walk all over him or not. Uwe slept in the Saab the nights after the fire. The first morning he tried to clear up among the ashes and destruction. The second morning he had to accept that this would never sort itself out. The house was lost, and all the work he had put into it. On the third morning, two men wearing the same kind of white shirt as that chief fireman turned up. They stood by his gate, apparently quite unmoved by the ruin in front of them. They didn't present themselves by name, only mentioned the name of the authority they came from, as if they were robots sent out by the mothership. "We've been sending you letters," said one of the white shirts, holding out a pile of documents for Uwe. "Many letters," said the other white shirt, and made a note in the pad. "You never answered," said the first, as if he were reprimanding a dog. Uwe just stood there, defiant. "Very unfortunate this," said the other, with a curt nod at what used to be Uwe's house. Uwe nodded. "The fire brigade says it was caused by a harmless electrical fault," continued the first white shirt robotically, pointing at a paper in his hand. Uwe felt a spontaneous objection to his use of the word harmless. "We've sent you letters," the second man repeated, waving his pad. "The municipal boundaries are being redrawn. The land where your house stands will be developed for a number of new constructions." "The land where your house stood," corrected his partner. "The council is willing to purchase your land at the market price," said the first man. "Well, a market price now that there's no longer a house on the land," clarified the other. Uwe took the papers, started reading. "You don't have much of a choice," said the first. "This is not so much your choice as the council's," said the other. The first man tapped his pen impatiently against the papers, pointing at a line at the bottom where it said signature. Uwe stood at his gate and read their document in silence. He became aware of an ache in his breast. It took a long, long time before he understood what it was. Hate, He hated those men in white shirts. He couldn't remember having hated anyone before, but now it was like a ball of fire inside. Uwe's parents had bought this house. Uwe had grown up here, learned to walk. His father had taught him everything there was to know about a Saab engine here. And after all that, someone at a municipal authority decided something else should be built here. And a man with a round face sold insurance that was not insurance. A man in a white shirt prevented Uwe from putting out a fire, and now two other white shirts stood here talking about a market price. But Uwe really did not have a choice. He could have stood there until the sun had completely risen, but he could not change the situation. So he signed their document while keeping his fist clenched in his pocket. He left the plot where once his parental home had stood, and he never looked back. Rented a little room from an old lady in town, sat and stared desolately at the wall all day. In the evening he went to work, cleaned the train compartments. In the morning he and the other workers were told not to go to their usual changing rooms. They had to go back to the head office to pick up new sets of work clothes. As Uwe was walking down the corridor, he met Tom. It was the first time they had seen each other since Uwe got blamed for the theft from the carriage. A more sensible man than Tom would probably have avoided eye contact or tried to pretend that the incident had never happened. But Tom was not a more sensible sort of man. "Well, if it isn't the little thief," he exclaimed with a combative smile. Uwe didn't answer. Tried to get past, but got a hard elbow from one of the younger colleagues Tom surrounded himself with. Uwe looked up. The younger colleague was smiling disdainfully at him. "Hold on to your wallets, the thief's here," Tom called out so loudly that his voice echoed through the corridors. With one hand, Uwe took a firmer grip on the pile of clothes in his arm, but he clenched his fist in his pocket. Went into an empty changing room, took off his dirty old work clothes, unclipped his father's dented wristwatch, and put it on the bench. When he turned around to go into the shower, Tom was standing in the doorway.
"We heard about the fire," he said.
Uwe could see that Tom was hoping he'd answer.
"That father of yours would have been proud of you. Not even he was useless enough to burn down his own bloody house," Tom called out to him as he was stepping into the shower.
Uwe heard his younger colleagues all laughing together. He closed his eyes, leaned his forehead against the wall, and let the hot water flow over him. Stood there for more than 20 minutes, the longest shower he'd ever had. When he came out, his father's watch was gone. Uwe rooted among the clothes on the bench, searched the floor, fine-combed all the lockers. A time comes in every man's life when he decides what sort of man he is going to be, whether he is the kind who lets other people tread on him or not. Maybe it was because Tom had put the blame on him for the theft in the carriage. Maybe it was the fire. Maybe it was the bogus insurance agent or the white shirts. Or maybe it was just enough now. There and then, it was as if someone had removed a fuse in Uwe's mind. Everything in his eyes grew a shade darker. He walked out of the changing room, still naked, and with water dripping from his flexing muscles. Walked to the end of the corridor to the foreman's changing room, kicked the door open, and cleared away through the astonished press of men inside. Tom was standing in front of a mirror at the far end, trimming his bushy beard. Uwe gripped him by the shoulder, and roared so loudly that the sheet metal-covered walls echoed.
"Give me back my watch!"
Tom, with a superior expression, looked down at his face. His dark figure towered over Uwe like a shadow.
"I don't have your book. Give it here!"
Uwe bellowed before Tom had reached the end of the sentence, so fiercely that the other men in the room saw fit to move a little closer to their lockers. A second later, Tom's jacket had been ripped away from him with such power that he didn't even think of protesting. He just stood there like a punished child as Uwe hauled out his wristwatch from the inside pocket. And then Uwe hit him, just once. It was enough. Tom collapsed like a sack of wet flour. By the time the heavy body hit the floor, Uwe had already turned and walked away. A time like that comes for every man, when he chooses what sort of man he wants to be. And if you don't know the story, you don't know the man. Tom was taken to the hospital. Again and again he was asked what had happened, but Tom's eyes just flickered and he mumbled something about having slipped. And strangely enough, none of the other men who'd been in the changing rooms at the time had any recollection of what had happened. That was the last time Uwe saw Tom, and, he decided, the last time he'd let anyone trick him. He kept his job as a night cleaner, but he gave up his job at the construction site. He no longer had a house to build, and anyway, he'd learned so much about construction by this point that the men in their hard hats no longer had anything to teach him. They gave him a toolbox as a farewell present. This time, with new-bought tools. "To the puppy, to help you build something that lasts," they'd written on a piece of paper. Uwe had no immediate use for it, so he carried it about aimlessly for a few days. Finally, the old lady renting him a room took pity on him and started looking for things around the house for him to mend. It was more peaceful that way for both of them. Later that year, he enlisted for military service. He scored the highest possible mark for every physical test. The recruitment officer liked this taciturn young man who seemed as strong as a bear, and he pressed him to consider a career as a professional soldier. Uwe thought it sounded good. Military personnel wore uniforms and followed orders. All knew what they were doing. All had a function. Things had a place. Uwe felt he could actually be good as a soldier. In fact, as he went down the stairs to have his obligatory medical examination, he felt lighter in his heart than he had for many years. As if he had been given a sudden purpose, a goal, something to be. His joy lasted no more than 10 minutes. The recruitment officer had said that the medical examination was a mere formality. But when the stethoscope was held against Uwe's chest, something was heard that should not have been heard. He was sent to a doctor in the city. A week later, he was informed that he had a rare congenital heart condition. He was exempted from any further military service. Uwe called and protested. He wrote letters. He went to 3 other doctors in the hope that a mistake had been made. It was no use. "Rules are rules," said a white-shirted man in the Army's administrative offices the last time Uwe went there to try to overturn the decision. Uwe was so disappointed that he did not even wait for the bus. Instead, he walked all the way back to the train station. He sat on the platform, more despondent than at any time since his father's death. A few months later, he would walk down that platform with the woman he was destined to marry. But at that precise moment, of course, he had no idea of this. He went back to his work as a night cleaner on the railways, grew quieter than ever. The old lady whose room he rented eventually grew so tired of his gloomy face that she arranged for him to borrow a nearby garage. After all, the boy had that car he was always fiddling with, she said. Maybe he could keep himself entertained with all that. Uwe took his entire Saab to pieces in the garage the next morning. He cleaned all the parts and then put them together again to see if he could do it, and to have something to do. When he was done with it, he sold the Saab at a profit and bought a newer but otherwise identical Saab 93. The first thing he did was to take it to pieces to see if he could manage it, and he could. His days passed like this, slow and methodical, and then one morning he saw her. She had brown hair and blue eyes and red shoes and a big yellow clasp in her hair. And then there was no more peace and quiet for Uwe. Chapter 13. A man called Uwe and a clown called Beppo.
"Uwe's funny," titters the 3-year-old with delight.
"Yeah," the 7-year-old mumbles, not at all as impressed.
She takes her little sister by the hand and walks with grown-up steps towards the hospital entrance.
Their mother looks as if she's going to have a go at Uwe, but seems to decide that there's no time for that. She waddles off towards the entrance, one hand on her pouting belly as if concerned that the child may try to escape. Uwe walks behind, dragging his steps. He doesn't care that she thinks it's easier just to pay up and stop arguing, because it's actually about the principal. Why is that parking attendant entitled to give Uwe a ticket for questioning why one has to pay for hospital parking? Uwe is not the sort of man who'll stop himself from roaring, "You're just a fake policeman," at a parking attendant. That's all there is to say about it. You go to the hospital to die. Uwe knows that. It's enough that the state wants to be paid for everything you do while you're alive. When it also wants to be paid for the parking when you go to die, Uwe thinks that's about far enough. He explained this in so many words to the parking attendant. And that's when the parking attendant started waving his book at him. And that's when Parvana started raging about how she'd be quite happy to pay up. As if that was the important part of the discussion. Women don't seem to get principles. He hears the 7-year-old complaining in front of him that her clothes are smelling of exhaust. Even though they kept the sob's windows rolled down all the way, it wasn't possible to get rid of the stench. The mother had asked Uwe what he'd really been doing in the garage, but Uwe had just answered with a sound, more or less like when you try to move a bathtub, by dragging it across some tiles. Of course, for the 3-year-old, it was the greatest adventure of her life, to be able to drive along in a car with all its windows down, although it was below freezing outside. The 7-year-old, on the other hand, had burrowed her face into her scarf and vented a good deal more skepticism. She'd been irritated about slipping around with her bottom on the sheets of newspaper Uwe had spread across the seat to stop them filthifying things. Uwe had also spread newspaper on the front seat, but her mother snatched it away before she sat down. Uwe had looked more than advisably displeased about this, but managed not to say anything. Instead, he constantly glanced at her stomach, all the way to the hospital, as if anxious that she might suddenly start leaking on the upholstery.
"Stand still here now,"
she says to the girls when they are in the hospital reception. They're surrounded by glass walls and benches, smelling of disinfectant. There are nurses in white clothes and colorful plastic slippers, and old people dragging themselves back and forth in the corridors, leaning on rickety walkers. On the floor is a sign announcing that Elevator 2 in Entrance A is out of order, and that visitors to Ward 114 are therefore asked to go to Elevator 1 in Entrance C. Beneath that is another message announcing that Elevator 1 in Entrance C is out of order, and visitors to Ward 114 are asked to go to Elevator 2 in Entrance A. Under that message is a third message announcing that Ward 114 is closed this month because of repairs. Under that message is a picture of a clown, informing people that Beppo the hospital clown is visiting sick children today.
"Where did Uwe get to now?"
Parvana bursts out.
"He went to the bathroom, I think," mumbles the 7-year-old. "Clown," says the 3-year-old, pointing happily at the sign.
"Do you know you have to pay them here to go to the bathroom?" Uwe exclaims incredulously.
Parvana spins around and gives Uwe a harassed look.
"Do you need to change?"
Uwe looks offended.
"Why would I need change?"
"For the bathroom."
"I don't need to go to the bathroom."
"But you said..."
she begins, then stops herself and shakes her head.
"Forget it, just forget it. When does the parking meter run out?" she asks instead.
10 minutes.
She groans.
"Don't you understand it'll take longer than 10 minutes?
"In that case, I'll go out and feed the meter in 10 minutes, says Uwe, as if this was quite obvious.
"Why don't you just pay for longer and save yourself the bother?"
she asks, and looks like she wishes she hadn't as soon as the question crosses her lips.
"Because that's exactly what they want. They're not getting a load of money for time we might not even use." "Oh, I don't have the strength for this,"
sighs Parvana, and holds her forehead. She looks at her daughters.
"Will you sit here nicely with Uncle Uwe while Mom goes to see how Dad is, please?"
"Yeah, yeah," agrees the 7-year-old grumpily.
"Yes!"
the 3-year-old shrieks with excitement.
"What?"
whispers Uwe. Parvana stands up.
"What do you mean with Uwe?" Where do you think you're going?
To his great consternation, the pregnant one seems not to register the level of upset in his voice.
You have to sit here and keep an eye on them, she states curtly,
and disappears down the corridor before Uwe can raise further objections. Uwe stands there, staring after her, as if he is expecting her to come rushing back and cry out that she was only joking, but she doesn't. So, Uwe turns to the girls. And in the next second, he looks as if he's just about to shine a desk lamp into their eyes and interrogate them on their whereabouts at the time of the murder.
Book!
Screams the 3-year-old at once and rushes off towards the corner of the waiting room, where there's a veritable chaos of toys, games, and picture books. Uwe nods, and having confirmed to himself that this 3-year-old seems to be reasonably self-motivating, he turns his attention to the 7-year-old.
Right. And what about you?
What do you mean, me?
She counters with indignation.
Do you need food, or do you have to go for a wee or anything like that?
The child looks at him as if he just offered her a beer and a cigarette.
I'm almost 8. I can go to the bathroom myself.
Uwe throws out his arms abruptly.
Sure, sure, so bloody sorry for asking.
She snorts.
You sword!
Yells the 3-year-old as she turns up again, running to and fro between Uwe's trouser legs. He skeptically peruses this grammatically challenged little natural disaster. She looks up and her whole face smiles at him.
Read,
she orders him in an excitable manner, holding up a book with her arms stretched out so far that she almost loses her balance. Uwe looks at the book, more or less, as if it just sent him a chain letter insisting that the book was really a Nigerian prince who had a very lucrative investment opportunity for Uwe, and now only needed Uwe's account number to sort something out.
Read,
she demands again, climbing the bench in the waiting room with surprising agility. Uwe reluctantly sits about a yard away on the bench. The 3-year-old sighs impatiently and disappears from sight, her head reappearing seconds later under his arm with her hands leaning against his knee for support and her nose pressed against the colorful pictures in the book.
Once upon a time, there was a little train, reads Uwe,
with all the enthusiasm of someone reciting a tax statement. Then he turns the page. The 3-year-old stops him and goes back. The 7-year-old shakes her head tiredly.
You have to say what happens on that page as well, and do voices,
she says. Uwe stares at her.
What?
He clears his throat mid-sentence.
What voices?
He corrects himself.
Fairy tale voices,
replies the 7-year-old.
You sword,
the 3-year-old announces with glee.
Did not, says Uwe.
Yes,
says the 3-year-old.
We're not doing any voices.
Maybe you're no good at reading stories,
notes the 7-year-old.
Maybe you're no good at listening to them, Uwe counters.
Maybe you're no good at telling them.
Uwe looks at the book, very unimpressed.
What kind of nonsense is this anyway? Some talking train? Is there nothing about cars?
Maybe there's something about nutty old men instead,
mutters the 7-year-old.
I'm not an old man, Uwe hisses.
Clown,
the 3-year-old cries out jubilantly.
And I'm not a clown either, he roars.
The older one rolls her eyes at Uwe, not unlike the way her mother often rolls her eyes at Uwe.
She doesn't mean you, she means the clown.
Uwe looks up and catches sight of a full-grown man who's quite seriously got himself dressed up as a clown, standing in the doorway of the waiting room. He's got a big, stupid grin on his face as well.
Clown!
The toddler howls, jumping up and down on the bench in a way that finally convinces Uwe that the kid is on drugs. He's heard about that sort of thing. They have that attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and get to take amphetamines on prescription.
And who's this little girl here, then? Does she want to see a magic trick, perhaps?
The clown exclaims helpfully and squelches over to them like a drunken moose in a pair of large red shoes, which, Uwe confirms to himself, only an utterly meaningless person would prefer to wear rather than getting himself a proper job. The clown looks gaily at Uwe.
Has Uncle got a 5-kroner piece, perhaps?
No, Uncle doesn't, perhaps, Uwe replies.
The clown looks surprised, which isn't an entirely successful look for a clown.
But, listen, it's a magic trick. You do have a coin on you, don't you? Mumbles the clown in his more normal voice, which contrasts quite strongly with his character and reveals that behind this idiotic clown, a quite ordinary idiot is hiding, probably all of 25 years old.
Come on, I'm a hospital clown. It's for the children's sake. I'll give it back. Just give him a 5-kroner coin, says the 7-year-old.
Clown! Screams the 3-year-old. Uwe peers down with exasperation at the tiny speech defect and wrinkles his nose.
Right, he says, taking out a 5-kroner piece from his wallet. Then he points at the clown. But I want it back, immediately. I'm paying for the parking with that.
The clown nods eagerly and snatches the coin out of his hand. Minutes later, Parvana comes back down the corridor to the waiting room. She stops, confusedly scanning the room from side to side. Are you looking for your girls? A nurse asks sharply behind her.
Yes,
Parvana answers, perplexed.
There,
says the nurse in a not entirely appreciative way and points at a bench by the large glass doors leading onto the parking area. Uwe is sitting there with his arms crossed, looking very angry. On one side of him sits the 7-year-old, staring up at the ceiling with an utterly bored expression, and on the other side sits the 3-year-old, looking as if she just found out she's going to have an ice cream breakfast every day for a whole month. On either side of the bench stand 2 particularly large representatives of the hospital's security guards, both with very grim facial expressions.
Are these your children? One of them asks.
He doesn't look at all as if he's having an ice cream breakfast.
Yes, what did they do?
Parvana wonders, almost terrified.
They didn't do anything, the other security guard replies, with a hostile stare at Uwe.
Me neither, Uwe mutters sulkily.
Uwe hit the clown,
the 3-year-old shrieks delightedly.
Snake, says Uwe.
Parvana stares at him, agape, and can't even think of anything to say.
He was no good at magic anyway, the 7-year-old groans. Can we go home now?
She asks, standing up.
Why, hold on, what? What clown?
The clown Beppo,
the toddler explains, nodding wisely.
He was gonna do magic, says her sister.
Stupid magic, says Uwe.
Like, he was going to make Uwe's 5-kroner coin go away, the 7-year-old elaborates.
And then he tried to give back another 5-kroner coin, Uwe interjects, with an insulted stare at the nearby security guards as if this should be enough of an explanation.
Uwe hit the clown, Mom.
The 3-year-old titters as if this was the best thing that ever happened in her whole life. Parvana stares for a long time at Uwe, the 3-year-old, 7-year-old, and the 2 security guards.
We're here to visit my husband. He's had an accident. I'm bringing in the children now to say hello to him, she explains to the guards.
Daddy fall, says the 3-year-old.
That's fine, one of the security guards nods. But this one stays here, confirms the other security guard and points at Uwe. I hardly hit him, I just gave him a little poke, Uwe mumbles, adding, bloody fake policeman, just to be on the safe side.
Honestly, he was no good at magic anyway, says the 7-year-old grumpily in Uva's defense, as they leave to visit their father.
An hour later, they are back at Uva's garage. The lanky one has one arm and one leg in casts and has to stay at the hospital for several days, Uwe has been informed by Parvana. When she told him, Uwe had to bite his lip very hard to stop himself laughing. He actually got the feeling Parvana was doing the same thing. The sob still smells of exhaust when he collects the sheets of newspaper from the seats.
Please, Uwe, are you sure you won't let me pay the parking fine? Says Parvana.
Is it your car? Uwe grunts.
No.
Well then, he replies.
But it feels a bit like it was my fault,
she says, concerned.
You don't hand out parking fines, the council does. So it's the bloody council's fault, says Uwe,
and closes the door of the Saab.
And those fake policemen at the hospital, he adds.
Clearly, still very upset that they forced him to sit without moving on that bench until Parvana came back to pick him up and they went home. As if he couldn't be trusted to wander about freely among the other hospital visitors. Parvana looks at him for a long time in thoughtful silence. The 7-year-old gets tired of waiting and starts walking across the parking area towards the house. The 3-year-old looks at Uwe with a radiant smile.
You're funny, she declares.
Uwe looks at her and puts his hands in his trouser pockets.
You shouldn't turn out too bad yourself.
The 3-year-old nods excitedly. Parvana looks at Uwe, looks at the plastic tube on the floor of his garage, looks at Uwe again, a touch worried.
I could do with a bit of help taking the ladder away, she says, as if she was in the middle of a much longer thought.
Uwe kicks distractedly at the asphalt.
And I think we have a radiator as well that doesn't work, she adds, a passing thought. Would be nice of you if you could have a look at it. Patrick doesn't know how to do things like that, you know, she says, and takes the 3-year-old by the hand.
Uwe nods slowly.
No, might have known.
Parvana nods. Then she suddenly gives off a satisfied smile.
And you can't let the girls freeze to death tonight, Uwe, right? It's quite enough that they had to watch you assault a clown, no?
Uwe gives her a dour glance. Silently, to himself, as if negotiating, he concedes that he can hardly let the children perish just because their no-good father can't open a window without falling off a ladder. That'd be a hellish amount of nagging from Uwe's wife if he went and arrived in the next world as a newly qualified child murderer. Then he picks up the plastic tube from the floor and hangs it up on a hook on the wall. Locks the Saab with the key, closes the garage, tugs at it 3 times to make sure it's closed, then goes to fetch his tools from the shed.
Tomorrow's as good a day as any to kill oneself.
Chapter 14. A man who was Uwe, and a woman on a train. She had a golden brooch pinned to her dress, in which the sunlight reflected hypnotically through the train window. It was 6:30 in the morning. Uwe had just clocked off his shift and was actually supposed to be taking the train home the other way. But then he saw her on the platform with all her rich auburn hair and her blue eyes and all her effervescent laughter. And he got back on the outbound train. Of course, he didn't quite know himself why he was doing it. He had never been spontaneous before in his life. But when he saw her, it was as if something malfunctioned. He convinced one of the conductors to lend him his spare pair of trousers and shirt so he didn't have to look like a train cleaner. And then Uwe went to sit by Sonia. It was the single best decision he would ever make. He didn't know what he was going to say, but he had hardly had time to sink into the seat before she turned to him cheerfully, smiled warmly, and said hello. And he found he was able to say hello back to her without any significant complications, and when she saw that he was looking at the pile of books she had in her lap, she tilted them slightly so he could read their titles. Uwe understood only about half the words.
"You like reading?" she asked him brightly.
Uwe shook his head with some insecurity, but it didn't seem to concern her very much. She just smiled, said that she loved books more than anything, and started telling him excitedly what each of the ones in her lap was about. And Uwe realized that he wanted to hear her talking about the things she loved for the rest of his life. He had never heard anything quite as amazing as that voice. She talked as if she were continuously on the verge of breaking into giggles. And when she giggled, she sounded the way Uwe imagined champagne bubbles would have sounded if they were capable of laughter. He didn't quite know what he should say to avoid seeming uneducated and stupid, but it proved to be less of a problem than he had thought. She liked talking, and Uwe liked keeping quiet. Retrospectively, Uwe assumed that was what people meant when they said that people were compatible. Many years later, she told him that she had found him quite puzzling when he came to sit with her in that compartment, abrupt and blunt in his whole being, but His shoulders were broad and his arms so muscular that they stretched the fabric of his shirt. And he had kind eyes. He listened when she talked, and she liked making him smile. Anyway, the journey to school was so boring that it was pleasant just to have some company. She was studying to be a teacher. Came on the train every day. After a couple miles, she changed to another train, then a bus. All in all, it was a 1.5-hour journey in the wrong direction for Uwe. Only when they crossed the platform that first time, side by side and stood by her bus stop, did she ask what he was doing there. And when Uwe realized that he was only 5 or so kilometers from the military barracks, where he would have been had it not been for that problem with his heart, the words slipped out of him before he understood why.
"I'm doing my military service over there," he said, waving vaguely.
"So maybe we'll see each other on the train going back as well. I go home at 5. Uwe couldn't think of anything to say. He knew, of course, that one does not go home from military installations at 5 o'clock, but she clearly did not. So he just shrugged. And then she got on her bus and was gone. Uwe decided that this was undoubtedly very impractical in many ways, but there was not a lot to be done about it. So he turned around, found a signpost pointing the way to the little center of the tiny student town where he now found himself, at least a 2-hour journey from his home, and then he started walking. After 45 minutes, he asked his way to the only tailor in the area and, after eventually finding the shop, ponderously stepped inside to ask whether it would be possible to have a shirt ironed and a pair of trousers pressed, and, if so, how long it would take. 10 minutes if you wait, came his answer. Then I'll be back at 4, said Uwe, and left. He wandered back down to the train station and lay down on a bench in the waiting hall. At 3:15, he went all the way back to the tailor's, had his shirt and trousers pressed while he sat waiting in his underwear in the staff restroom, then walked back to the station and took the train with her for 1.5 hours back to her station, and then traveled for 1.5 hours to his own station. He repeated the whole thing the day after, and the day after that. On the following day, the man from the ticket desk at the train station intervened and made it clear to Uwe that he couldn't sleep here like some loafer. Surely he could understand that. Uwe saw the point he was making, but explained that there was a woman at stake here. When he heard this, the man from the ticket desk gave him a little nod, and from then on let him sleep in the left luggage room. Even men at train station ticket desks have been in love. Uwe did the same thing every day for 3 months. In the end, she grew tired of his never inviting her out for dinner, so she invited herself instead. "I'll be waiting here tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock. I want you to be wearing a suit, and I'd like you to invite me out for dinner," she said succinctly as she stepped off the train one Friday evening. And so it was. Uwe had never been asked how he lived before he met her, but if anyone had asked him, he would have answered that he didn't. On Saturday evening, he put on his father's old brown suit. It was tight around his shoulders. Then he ate 2 sausages and 7 potatoes, which he prepared in the little kitchenette in his room, before doing his rounds of the house to put in a couple of screws, which the old lady had asked him to do. "Are you meeting someone?" she asked, pleased to see him coming down the stairs. She had never seen him wearing a suit. Uwe nodded gruffly. "Yeah," he said in a way that could be described as either a word or an inhalation. The older woman nodded and probably tried to hide a little smile. "It must be someone very special if you've dressed yourself up like that," she said. Uwe inhaled again and nodded curtly. When he was at the door, she called out from the kitchen. "Flowers, Uwe!" Perplexed, Uwe stuck his head around the partition wall and stared at her. "She'd probably like some flowers," the old woman declared with some emphasis. Uwe cleared his throat and closed the front door. For more than 15 minutes, he stood waiting for her at the station in his tight-fitting suit and his new polished shoes. He was skeptical about people who came late. "If you can't depend on someone being on time, you shouldn't trust them with anything more important either," he used to mutter when people came dribbling along with their time cards 3 or 4 minutes late, as if this didn't matter. As if the railway line would just lie there waiting for them in the morning and not have something better to do, so for each of those 15 minutes that Uwe stood waiting at the station, he was slightly irritated. And then the irritation turned into a certain anxiety. And after that, he decided that Sonya had only been ribbing him when she'd suggested they should meet. He had never felt so silly in his entire life. Of course she didn't want to go out with him. How could he have gotten that into his head? His humiliation, when the insight dawned on him, welled up like a stream of lava, and he was tempted to toss the flowers in the nearest trash can and march off without turning around. Looking back, he couldn't quite explain why he stayed. Maybe because he felt, in spite of it all, that an agreement to meet was an agreement. And maybe there was some other reason, something a little harder to put his finger on. He didn't know it at that moment, of course, but he was destined to spend so many quarter hours of his life waiting for her that his old father would have gone cross-eyed if he'd found out. And when she did finally turn up, in a long floral print skirt and a cardigan so red that it made Uwe shift his weight from his right foot to his left, he decided that maybe her inability to be on time was not the most important thing. The woman at the florist's had asked him what he wanted. He informed her gruffly that this was a bit of a bloody question to ask. After all, she was the one who sold the greens, and he the one who bought them, not the other way around. The woman had looked a bit bothered about that, but then she asked if the recipient of the flowers had some favorite color, perhaps. Pink, Uwe had said with great certainty, although he did not know. And now she stood outside the station, with his flowers pressed happily to her breast, in that red cardigan of hers, making the rest of the world look as if it were made in grayscale. "They're absolutely beautiful," she said, smiling in that candid way that made Uwe stare down at the ground and kick at the gravel. Uwe wasn't much for restaurants. He had never understood why one would ever eat out for a lot of money when one could eat at home. He wasn't so taken with show-off furniture and elaborate cooking, and he was very much aware of his conversational shortcomings as well. Whatever the case, he had eaten in advance so he could afford to let her order whatever she wanted from the menu, while opting for the cheapest dish for himself. And at least if she asked him something, he wouldn't have his mouth full of food. To him it seemed like a good plan. While she was ordering, the waiter smiled ingratiatingly. Uwe knew all too well what both he and the other diners in the restaurant had thought when they came in. She was too good for Uwe, that's what they thought, and Uwe felt very silly about that, mostly because he entirely agreed with their opinion. She told him with great animation about her studies, about books she'd read or films she'd seen. And when she looked at Uwe, she made him feel, for the first time, that he was the only man in the world. And Uwe had enough integrity to realize that this wasn't right, that he couldn't sit here lying any longer. So he cleared his throat, collected his faculties, and told her the whole truth. That he wasn't doing his military service at all, that in fact he was just a simple cleaner on the trains who had a defective heart, and who had lied for no other reason than that he enjoyed riding with her on the train so very much. He assumed this would be the only dinner he ever had with her, and he did not think she deserved having it with a fraudster. When he had finished his story, he put his napkin on the table and got out his wallet to pay. "I'm sorry," he mumbled, shame-faced, and kicked his chair leg a little before adding, in such a low voice that it could hardly even be heard, "I just wanted to know what it felt like to be someone you look at." As he was getting up, she reached across the table and put her hand on his. "I've never heard you say so many words before," she smiled. He mumbled something about how this didn't change the facts, he was a liar. When she asked him to sit down again, he obliged her and sank back into his chair. She wasn't angry, the way he thought she'd be. She started laughing. In the end, she said it hadn't actually been so difficult working out that he wasn't doing his military service because he never wore a uniform. Anyway, everyone knows soldiers don't go home at 5 o'clock on weekdays. Uwe had hardly been as discreet as a Russian spy, she added. She'd come to the conclusion that he had his reasons for it. And she'd liked the way he listened to her and made her laugh. And that, she said, had been more than enough for her. and then she asked him what he really wanted to do with his life, if he could choose anything he wanted. And he answered, without even thinking about it, that he wanted to build houses, construct them, draw the plans, calculate the best way to make them stand where they stood. And then she didn't start laughing as he thought she would. She got angry.
"But why don't you do it, then?" she demanded.
Uwe did not have a particularly good answer to that one. On the following Monday, she came to his house with brochures for a correspondence course leading to an engineering qualification. The old landlady was quite overwhelmed when she looked at the beautiful young woman walking up the stairs with self-confident steps. Later, she tapped Uwe's back and whispered that those flowers were probably a very good investment. Uwe couldn't help but agree. When he came up to his room, she was sitting on his bed. Uwe stood sulkily in the doorway with his hands in his pockets. She looked at him and laughed.
"Are we an item now?" she asked.
"Well, yes," he replied hesitantly. "I suppose it could be that way." And then it was that way. She handed him the brochures. It was a 2-year course, and it proved that all the time Uwe had spent learning about house building had not, after all, been wasted, as he'd once believed. Maybe he did not have much of a head for studying in a conventional sense, but he understood numbers and he understood houses. That got him far. He took the examination after 6 months, then another, and another. Then he got a job at the housing office and stayed there for more than a third of a century. Worked hard, was never ill, paid his mortgage, paid taxes, did his duty. Bought a little 2-story row house in a recently constructed development in the forest. She wanted to get married, so Uwe proposed. She wanted children, which was fine with him, said Uwe. And their understanding was that children should live in row housing developments among other children. And less than 40 years later, there was no forest around the house anymore, just other houses. And one day she was lying there in a hospital and holding his hand and telling him not to worry, everything was going to be all right. Easy for her to say, thought Uwe, his breast pulsating with anger and sorrow. But she just whispered, "Everything will be fine, darling Uwe," and leaned her arm against his arm, and then gently pushed her index finger into the palm of his hand, and then closed her eyes and died. Uwe stayed there, with her hand in his, for several hours, until the hospital staff entered the room with warm voices and careful movements, explaining that they had to take her body away. Uwe rose from his chair, nodded, and went to the undertakers to take care of the paperwork. On Sunday, she was buried. On Monday, he went to work. But if anyone had asked, he would have told them that he never lived before he met her, and not after, either. Chapter 15. A Man Called Uwe and a Delayed Train. The slightly porky man on the other side of the plexiglass has back-combed hair and arms covered in tattoos. As if it isn't enough to look like someone has slapped a pack of margarine over his head, he has to cover himself in doodles as well. There's not even a proper motif, as far as Uwe can see, just a lot of patterns. Is that something an adult person in a healthy state of mind would consent to? Going about with his arms looking like a pair of pajamas?
"Your ticket machine doesn't work," Uwe informs him.
"No?" says the man behind the plexiglass.
"What do you mean, no? I mean, I'm asking, doesn't it work? I just told you it's broken."
The man behind the plexiglass looks dubious.
"Maybe there's something wrong with your card, some dirt on the magnetic strip," he suggests.
Uwe looks as if the man behind the plexiglass has just raised the possibility of Uwe having erectile dysfunction. The man behind the plexiglass goes silent.
"There's no dirt on my magnetic strip, you can be sure of that," Uwe splutters.
The man behind the plexiglass nods, then changes his mind and shakes his head. Tries to explain to Uwe that the machine actually worked earlier in the day. Uwe dismisses this as utterly irrelevant, of course, because it is clearly broken now.
The man behind the plexiglass wonders if Uwe has cash instead. Uwe replies that this is none of his bloody business. A tense silence settles. At long last, the man behind the plexiglass